Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
We compare our insides to other people's outsides. You really have to retain this. Like, you almost have to have it on a post-it on your computer every single day. Your insides, there's all this conflict and like consideration. I mean, you know, in terms of all the different careers that you could pivot towards, all the different people you could be friends with. Like, should I invest continually in this relationship that's not working for me? Should I spend more time with this new person who seems really interesting to me? We have a lot of conflict in our lives and difficulties. And when we play in that space, we're not avoiding our negative emotions. We're not accepting our negative emotions, but we're actually channeling and working with them. That's where the growth takes place. And that's where we start to make better decisions in terms of what is going to help us, not just in the present moment, as you said, feeling good, but actually lead me to live a life that I'm actually proud of and it's meaningful and impactful.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Todd, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure to have you here. So you have one of those books that I came across, I think, just based on my Amazon reading history called The Upside of Your Dark Side, all of which we will get into. And I know part of the answer to this question from having done my research on you, but I still want to hear the rest of it. So I wanted to start by asking you, what birth order were you and what impact did that end up having on what you've ended up doing with your life and your career?
Well, interesting for me because I'm a twin. And I am 9 minutes older than my twin brother. And those 9 minutes have made the whirlwind of difference of our entire personalities and lives.
Yeah, say more about that.
Well, there's something about when you have the twins and I'm the first one to be held by my mom and my grandparents, where all of the aspirations that they've had for generations. I mean, and I have like most Jewish Americans, you know, I have trace things back to the Holocaust out in Germany, is everything was put on me of in terms of what everyone hoped to be for the second generation in America. And my brother had so much less pressure on him growing up. And that pressure made me more sociable, more approach-oriented, risk-taking. And because people started to define me by those personality traits, as opposed to I was doing it to get attention and admiration from them, that it made him less and less social and less ambitious.
That is that crazy that 9 minutes would make that much of a difference, because I've always known that there's a difference between, you know, birth orders, like how people are, you know, me and my sister are 5 years apart, but I would never have gathered that 9 minutes could make that much of a difference. Like, why is something as what's seemingly insignificant as 9 minutes such a big difference maker? Like, what is the science or psychology behind that?
This is a great opening to this entire nature of like mastering the psychology of human behavior, because it's not really the 9 minutes. It's how everyone shoved in their expectations within who came out first, right? It's just just like walking into an interview in terms of there's a recency effect and a primacy effect. So the first person that gets an interview when you have a large group of people in the waiting room, gets extra attention. And so does the last person. That's basically the final piece of the equation. And so this recency effect or this primacy effect of me coming out first, I mean, there's a good chunk of research showing is that that child tends to be the more intelligent and creative child of the two. And part of it is because, you are basically adult caregivers are more defined by the first character that comes to the door.
Wow. So are you and your brother just wildly different people, even though you're twins?
You're making me realize I'd love to do a podcast with my twin brother here. He's one of the reasons I went into psychology. It's because we are so different. One of the interesting things about the two of us, and this is a nice setting point for what our conversation is going to be, is we both applied early to Cornell University as growing up in New York, and 8 people applied early. We both were in those 8. And back then you get an envelope. And so we all agreed to open it up together before the school day started. And we all opened up our envelopes on a count of 3. Every person got into Cornell except for me. And they're jumping up and down and all excited. And I had to walk with my head down, as the bell rang, as they're still out there talking about what they're going to do in Ithaca and climb gorges and go hiking. And that moment, I was so enraged and embarrassed that I made it my mission to transfer into an Ivy League school.
Well, okay. So there's a lot here to unpack. And you mentioned being Jewish American. So, as I always have to ask my Jewish guests, from what I hear, being raised in a Jewish family is pretty similar to being raised in an Indian family. The expectation is doctor, lawyer, engineer, or failure.
Completely true.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, you're an educator. So I want to do a bit of a deep dive into education because anytime I talk to an educator, I have mounds of questions. I always jokingly say that I'm a failed byproduct of the system. My sister went to Berkeley, ended up becoming a doctor, chief anesthesiology resident at Yale. I went to Berkeley, got shit grades, got fired from every job. I mean, you and I were talking about this yesterday about how we don't learn to study. But I'm curious about two things. One was, what was the narrative about education in your family and making your way in the world? What were you taught about the role and the value of education by your parents?
And you ask interesting questions. I mean, my grandmother slipped a dictionary underneath the pillow of my twin brother and I. For years, we both had neck problems. And I used to see orthopedists and chiropractors. And then one day I just looked up, because who lifts up their mattress to see what's under there? And so one day I just lifted it up and I was like, go put a dictionary underneath my bed. And she was like, I read a biography about Albert Einstein, and he slept with a dictionary under his bed. And I thought that, unconsciously, this would help you become more intelligent over the 8 hours that you sleep each day. And it's just a great indicator of my grandmother who raised me in terms of her attitude of, not only am I going to focus on this as you get tests and quizzes, where is the other 3% when you get a 97 as a grade? But I'm even going to make you think about this when you're conked out and unconscious to think about education. So it was the reason we were the golden childs of, she's had 6 grandkids, was that him and I, my twin brother and I, Andrew, we were the most interested in listen, we'll get great grades and then maybe we can squeeze in on the side socializing and playing some sports here and there. So it was always a focus. But I love the fact that my grandma always said is that you can always decide later as you live to 90. When you decide you don't want to learn anything more, you don't want to read anything more, but you want to open as many doors as humanly possible. And that lens is why I chose to go into clinical psychology versus biological, developmental, or cognitive psychology, was that I knew more doors would be open. That maybe I was going to write a book and maybe I'd be on, a podcast like with you here. And those options are not as available when you went into these more specialized, variants of psychology.
Yeah. Well, let's talk specifically about education. I mean, you're a professor, you teach at a university, you alluded to this moment of the envelope. And of course, I think all of us back in those days remember getting the envelope. It was pretty clear. If you got the big envelope, it was like, okay, I got in. Cool. I know. In the wake of the college admission scandal, especially when I saw the Rick Singer documentary, and I've talked to a few professors about this before, you watch these kids and their reactions nowadays to whether they get it or not. And it's like they have been fed this narrative that this is like the moment that will make or break your life. And it's funny because we had Jennifer Wallace here who wrote what I think is arguably one of the most important books this year called Never Enough, When the Achievement Mindset Becomes Toxic. And she talked about, you know, how much pressure these kids face today and how, you know, they've been taught to believe this, even though there's no correlation. She said, believe it or not, the University of Wisconsin apparently has the highest number of CEOs of big companies. Huh. But you're an educator. And so this is something I've asked dozens of educators, mainly because I'm eventually going to write a blog post about this. But let's say that you were tasked with redesigning the entire system from the ground up. And for better or worse, that we're making you the director of education policy. You know, goodbye Betsy DeVos, even though she's no longer there, thank God. But basically, you're taking over the role that she had. What would you change and how would you do it?
I mean, honestly, I think we need a more ideographic, personalized educational approach. And what that means is on a regular basis, right now we have a system where at the age of around 7 or 9, you basically assess people whether they have a gifted and talented potential, which is absolutely a bizarre concept in terms of your 7-year-old self with almost no metacognitive awareness, like thinking about thinking, like what are your feelings about your feelings. At that stage, you just don't have like a philosophy of life to determine whether or not you're going to be exceptional at something. And so my alternative would be you're going to do constantly collecting data on a matrix of people's personality dimensions, their interests, and their values. Those three bins right there. And then you are going to help guide people towards make sure that where they learn the basics, like yesterday we were talking about note taking, and you could talk about how do you actually read an article? How do you read a book effectively to actually acquire information so it goes from short-term memory to long-term memory? And how do you develop like creative original thoughts and criticisms and branch offs when you read something? When you think that this is the, you're reading and hearing from one of the experts on this topic, who am I at age 11 to make any criticisms about what someone wrote about World War II? And so if you start from the place of, we're going to make figure out what are you initially attracted to and then try to teach you all of the basic and secondary topics through that lens. So if sports is your thing and you're obsessed about, you know, the new Beckham documentary on Netflix and you follow the World Cup, you know, men's and women's, then you want a teacher to be giving as many metaphors and analogies as possible in that domain. And if your thing is technology, well, then you can learn math, reading, and history through the lens of technology. And it's kind of amazing that we don't do this.
Yeah. So I guess the bigger question then is why? Like, what is preventing us from doing this? Let's start there because I also have some questions about, you know, sort of what you've seen in the evolution of the way people learn in your tenure. But I mean, what is the thing that is preventing this? Is it policy? Is it bureaucracy? Like, I remember when we had Seth Godin, he said parents are the people who have the power to change things.
Right. And parents often are overburdened, and we give too much of the attribution pie of successes and failures onto parents. I believe like this is an important element of society. Not that they're not important, but I think we put too much weight on their behavior. And the science backs up is that after you hit like your mid adolescent years, your primary focus is what are your peers doing as opposed to what adults are doing. And so to not consider what are the social norms and peers in terms of, is it cool to have your backpack in school? Like, is it cool to like get good grades? Like, do you get social status if you get into a good college and are working towards a good college? And we know that there are, you know, racial differences and subculture differences in urban environments and rural environments all over the US, where aspiring to be exceptional and excellent in learning, growing as a person, and basically making an impact on the world and not just money is devalued in a lot of places. And so it's not so much the parents as what is the social system that they're involved in. And when I think of like what prevents us from really innovative solutions to education, it's more of the question of why is there a status quo bias and why do people conform so much? And you could think of in a simple way, conformity is influenced by two questions that often we don't even think about consciously. One of them is,
if this is such a better way of doing education, Todd, like why aren't other people who are smarter than you thinking about it and doing it? So that prevents me from talking about it other than with you on this podcast right now. Like I've never written anything about a manifesto for improving the educational system, thinking that there are experts that are out there. And the second question is, what's going to be the social penalty in terms of punishment for me deviating from what other people are saying and doing? Like, am I ready to get 1,000 negative comments sent to my email after I give a workshop or a talk on this topic, especially from teachers and administrators who have so much skin in the game that they don't want to do any extra work and they're not going to be convinced that in the next 15 years, it's worth it for them to add extra work because there's a better way of doing things. And this is an inefficiency in the system to challenge the status quo. And I think we have to acknowledge that before we can figure out how to support dissenting better ideas.
Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at UH1.com. That's UH1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Well, I think that the other thing that you brought up was interesting is sort of creating a, you know, multifaceted sort of portrait of somebody. Because if you think about sort of the college admissions process itself, it's like, how much can you really communicate what you value and who you are in one sort of five paragraph essay? And you know, I think that the other thing that I think about is how we make all these decisions about, you know, who we are, what we want to do with our lives, before we have any data points. David Epstein writes about this in Range, where I think he calls it something that I don't remember the exact terminology. It's like, you know, the history bias, but he talks about the fact that every point in your life, like you will actually change from, and he says that, yeah, at 18 is a particularly bad time to be making long-term decisions. Yet, you know, we have people like, I remember hearing people like, I'm going to go to medical school. It's like, have you ever set foot in a hospital? Do you even know what it's like to work in one? Because there are a lot of people, I think, that if they actually saw the reality of the thing that they think they want to do, they would change their minds.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's actually a great question. Like, what percentage of people who are in a multi-decade career had direct exposure of spending more than an hour with someone who was in that career before they set off on that path? I mean, I'm not one of those people. I mean, I didn't spend time with a psychologist.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, speaking of being a psychologist, and then I think this will make a perfect segue into the book. One thing I always wonder about, it, particularly people like you who are both psychologists, but also parents, do you have to navigate the same like tremendous amount of bullshit that every parent does, like teenagers who are assholes? And how do you draw the line between being a father and being a psychologist? Because like, I always wonder if your dad, you know, you ever get your kids saying, you stop being a psychologist and just be my dad for a minute.
You definitely have like a sense where we're collecting our conversations in the kitchen. You know, I think one of the benefits of writing a book or doing research on a topic is it forces you to avoid hypocrisy. So, you know, when I wrote a book on curiosity, I made sure I'm like, God, I got to be asking lots of questions when I meet new people. And I have to definitely be choosing novelty over familiarity more often. And when I wrote this book on The Upside of Your Dark Side, I was like, I got to be more comfortable with being embarrassed and anxious and angry and sad. Or else I'm going to be a hypocrite. I'm reading all this research. And so I have a parenting book plan. I just want to make sure that my kids don't end up as homeless drug addicts. As I'm in the middle of writing the book when I turn 23. But what it does is it forces me to think about, well, what are the best strategies to get the desired outcomes I want? So as a parent of three daughters, one of the most important things to me is getting intel, which I'm basically like a CIA, FBI agent. And so what that requires is that I have to be very non-judgmental to things that I have incredibly emotionally intense judgments about. So when they're dating, when they're getting, when they're drinking.
I knew that was coming. I was like, three girls. I was like, the dating thing has to come up here.
Yeah. And then like, this is a different era. I mean, it's amazing how society changes. Like edibles are totally socially acceptable and legal in the state of Virginia. So, you know, if my kid takes an edible, which it happened once, and then I find them, like, how do I respond to it? When one of their friends like ends up like engaging in self-injurious behavior and tries to take a whole bottle of pills. Do I respond in a way that both tries to solve the problem, but also make sure I don't close the door to more intel in the future? And that, like when those frameworks or lenses of what will get me the greatest intel is one of the most valuable things about parenting. It's not the actual behavior. It's like, look, what's your system? And so for me, like I could talk to like their mom and complain about them, how horrible they are, how annoying, like we just created like horrible kids, like in that moment, but they will not hear it. And so I get access to things that most dads don't from their daughters because like, I really try hard to not sex segregate their behavior. Like I don't say, hey, come to the door when they have a boyfriend that comes and says, listen, I have my gun there. I'm wearing a tight t-shirt so they can see my biceps. Like I don't do any of that. I asked them a bunch of questions about the big five personality traits to figure out like, hey, are they a thinking person? Are they like, you know, are they like willing to engage with me? Because I want them to like be with really interesting, fun people. And I also want to know their personality. It's a much better approach than playing prototypical 50s dad, where you just try to intimidate them.
Mm. Well, let's get into the book. I mean, what was the impetus for this book? Because I think the title right away grabbed me. I was like, The Upside of Your Dark Side. I was like, wow, this is one of those things that you kind of think you're like, really? There's an upside to a dark side? But as I read the book, I realized, yeah, okay, this is really, you know, calling into question a lot of conventional wisdom. You and I talked about just sort of survivorship bias being ripe in success literature. So what was the impetus for writing this book in particular?
Yeah, there's a number of things. Let me start with one that's like, that I wonder if you remember this. Do you remember when on social media, I think it was Facebook, where everybody got a score
for what percentage were their posts positive versus negative? And it gave you a ranking with all of your friends on Facebook. And I remember I had this friend of mine, I'm not going to reveal his name, and he had like a 96% of his words were positive. And he was number one out of like 3,300 friends. And he was so proud of it. And I was thinking to myself, that's messed up. Like, there's no way you can communicate effectively and deal with conflict and deal with annoying people who like cut you in line, cut, you know, and like overcharge you at a restaurant or rude to you as a waiter and a waitress. You know, just try to pull rank on you, like in terms of like a boss or a supervisor, and you're like 96% positive. It goes in there. So it was all of these kind of happiness trends that became very big with, you know, Martin Seligman coming up with positive psychology and really bringing that to the forefront of the self-help industry. And then companies were, you know, still to this day, I mean, Deloitte does it where they have happiness workshops right now, which I thought it passed, where we realized like we don't want happy slaves in the workplace who like are going to be, you know, feel pleased regardless of what their work is. We want people to be agile and like basically be very sensitive to, is this a situation where I'm being mistreated? Is this a situation where I should be upset? And all of these trends to focus on happiness as the elixir of life and the fundamental aim of life made me want to write a book, because I knew there was so much science of saying of, listen, there's a reason evolutionary wise over 200,000 years that we have a full, you know, range, this toolbox of emotions and personality traits. And there's a reason that there's narcissism and there's a reason that there's righteous indignation. And I want to just call together, you know, all my colleagues' great work and just put a flag in and say, happiness is really enjoyable, but it should not be your life aim. And that's a provocative statement to say.
You know, it's funny. I just finished reading the Toxic Positivity book, by I think Whitney Woodward, I think is her name. I might have that wrong. But, the interesting thing was she ended it by saying that happiness as a goal is actually paradoxically less likely to make you happy. And you actually open, your book by saying, not surprisingly, the leading predictor of success in elite military training programs is the same quality that distinguishes those best equipped to resolve marital conflict, to achieve favorable deal terms in business negotiations, and to bestow the gifts of good parenting on their children, the ability to tolerate psychological discomfort. This is what psychologists refer to as distress tolerance, a quality found in people who can handle the emotional equivalent of camping, no shampoo, flush toilets, or walls to keep out creepy crawlers, who don't shy away from anger, guilt, or boredom just because they feel bad. And I think that, you know, that in and of itself is a provocative way to begin a book, because there's so much emphasis, I think, on feeling good. And, you know, I think it gets people caught up in what one of our former guests, Wiley McGraw, referred to as the self-help hell loop, where they're actually doing all this stuff that makes them feel good, but doesn't actually lead to anything good. Talk to me about why we actually have such a low distress tolerance for these kinds of things, and you know, what it is that causes that distress tolerance to increase, and how we start to build it more of it into our lives.
Yeah, there's a lot in there. I like what Brian Little from Harvard talks about, doing good versus being good. Like, to really think carefully about what are you striving towards, and like what are your ultimate concerns. And when you think about pursuing aspirational goals, there's always going to be like great deals of stress and really big trade-offs in terms of your expenditure of any energy, money, time, attention. We have a limited amount every single day. And so having to know that there's a cost of, if I decide that I get a keynote to work with, you know, to work with Mercedes-Benz and travel to another country, the trade-off is I'm going to probably miss one of my kids' sporting events. And I think thinking about trade-offs is one of the best ways of realizing is that these negative emotions aren't bad. They are often indicators of like what we care about most. And you could think about this. I know this isn't exactly the answer to your question. You could think about this as a series of questions, which is, do you want to get better at detecting deception and lying? Well, if that's the case, happiness is much worse than a mild amount of anger and sadness. Like, do you want to produce persuasive messages? I mean, you've got from Robert Cialdini onward about how to, you know, be persuasive and influential. But what we know is that slight levels of sadness and irritation make you more persuasive in talking to a room full of people than when you're in a happy mood. And when you want to restore your social standing after you're embarrassed or you fail at something, or you want to stimulate your own effort and your performance, or motivate other people in the locker room, we know that angry speeches at halftime in sporting events are much more effective on second half performances than happy, prideful speeches. But so there's all of this. You can go through almost every single negative emotion and say, what is the rationale that we have this in our repertoire? And I think one of the reasons that we have intolerance of these distressing emotions is that we live it. Every single decade is the most comfortable decade for humans to live in. And there's plenty of books out there, you know, Steven Pinker at the top of the list, in terms of we've never had more abundance in society, but it's coupled with so much pessimism. And the reason is because we know that moral outrage and problematic things get more eyeballs and attention. So people spend more time thinking about it. And you often forget to be grateful for all the things you don't have to worry about anymore. And I just remember when I lived in New York City of how many people, and this is not a political comment, but how many people that were homeless also had smartphones. And it wasn't of like, these people are doing extremely well, but it was like amazing that I was watching people play Angry Birds as they're sleeping on cardboard on the street, thinking of, this is a really interesting paradox in terms of both abundance and deficits occurring simultaneously. And we forget, like, just like you said earlier, which is that most of us for our jobs did not spend sufficient time of stepping into a hospital or a law firm to know what that job is like. We don't know what it's like to feel to be a woman in 1950 and to be, you know, a black man in 1908 and to have those experiences. Like, we can read history, but you really need to hear firsthand accounts, and you have to feel, not just think about, like, how much we've accomplished. And we are so comfortable, but we're not conscious of it, that it makes us lacking in the skill to deal with those moments where we're not doing well. We do feel physical pain. We do feel psychological pain. We basically, we're out of practice compared to the prior generations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, you say that it's only when we're unwilling to take on the inevitable pain in life, whether it's the death of a parent, divorce, or not getting some big promotion at work, that pain turns into something we experience as suffering. Suffering arises when we turn our backs on an escalation in emotional, physical, or social discomfort. And like I said, I think that the overemphasis on sort of positivity and what has effectively turned into toxic positivity has been really detrimental for us. Dan Pink even talked about this in his book on regret. He said, you know, we're over-indexed on positive emotions. And he said, you know, positive emotions are good, but he said negative emotions are essential for healthy living. So one thing I'm curious about is, what role do you think that sort of popular culture, social media, you know, what I now affectionately call the self-improvement industrial complex and all these sort of self-help books have played in creating effectively our intolerance for discomfort and negativity? Because I feel like you can't scroll through social media without sort of just a bunch of bullshit motivational platitudes that sound good in theory, but mean absolutely nothing to somebody who's really suffering.
Yeah. We had a little bit of this conversation yesterday about the difference between the theoretical and the practical. And I'm glad that you're saying that. I mean, you know, let's couple social media with social comparison. So it actually predates social media, which is we have never in the history of humanity had so much exposure to what other people are thinking, doing, and how they're living. Like, we just have access to, it's basically reality TV to other people's lives. It's not a full picture, but it's a sufficient enough picture for us constantly actually calibrating how we're doing, not from our internal compass and our values, but from other people are showcasing themselves. And what we forget, and this is Alain de Botton, like, talks about this, is we compare our insides to other people's outsides, and we're not, like, you really have to retain this. Like, you almost have to have it on a post-it on your computer every single day. Like, you're constantly, like, your insides is, there's all this conflict and, like, consideration. I mean, you know, in terms of all the different careers that you could pivot towards, all the different people you could be friends with. Like, should I invest continually in this relationship that's not working for me? Should I spend more time with this new person who seems really interesting to me. We have a lot of conflict in our lives and difficulties. And when we play in that space, we're not avoiding our negative emotions. We're not accepting our negative emotions, but we're actually channeling and working with them. That's where the growth takes place. And that's where we start to make better decisions in terms of what is going to help us, not just in the present moment, as you said, feeling good, but actually lead me to live a life that I'm actually proud of and it's meaningful and impactful. That gets to Dan Pink's concept of regret. Like, our biggest psychological pain is not by taking risks and failing. It's always the inaction, right? The end of the date, you decide like not to try to kiss the girl or the guy. That's the one that haunts you for, you know, for 25 years. And it's the, you know, you're in the office and you have to make a decision. Do you say that you want a pay raise or a promotion to do something else? When you don't say, speak up, and it was on your mind and you prepared for it, it haunts you for decades. And so those regrets, as Dan Pink talks about, which is based on the work by Danny Kahneman, is a motivational impetus for us not to do that again, the inaction, even in other unrelated life domains. So if you decide not to ask for a raise when you get that opportunity to go into your manager's office, if you sit with that regret and you actually like marinated it and feel the pain from that, you're probably less inclined to have an avoidance stonewalling approach when you're talking to your family at the dinner table, and you're actually probably going more likely to express the things that bother you versus suppress them. Mm-hmm.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at UH1.com. That's UH1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Well, you know, I think that one thing you talk about are things that, like, we try to basically put, you know, sort of, again, platitudes over, particularly doubt, which I thought was really interesting. You said what many people fail to realize is the fact that doubt in moderation performs a healthy function. Doubt is a psychological state that prompts us to take stock of our skills and to work to improve areas where they might be deficient. And it honestly made me think of an example, which is how this podcast started. You know, Sid Savara, who was the co-founder, I had emailed him about starting a multi-author blog, and he replied back saying, "That's a terrible idea. You're not a very good writer, but you're a great interviewer. So you should spin this out into a separate site and do that instead." And of course, an hour later, I mocked up the first version of the site. But there's a term that I coined after a conversation with my friend, Sam Duggan, who runs the Financial Samurai podcast, what I call the paradox of receptive resistance. And because we were both talking about this idea that he had written this post where he kind of, you know, implicitly criticized me, and I got really pissed and I hated him for years. And it's funny because we both laugh about it now. I just thought he was an asshole, and he told me he was getting killed at work. But I told him, I was like, you know, what's amazing is that you weren't wrong about what you said. And so we had talked about the fact that, you know, we are so much less open to feedback when we need it most. And I was like, I basically was like, this is the term. The paradox of receptive resistance is a profound observation about the human condition, particularly during our formative years. It encapsulates the idea that during our youth, when we're most in need of and should be most open to constructive feedback and hard truths, we're often most resistant to it. This resistance is largely due to the fragility of our ego and our natural inclination to seek validation and approval. And I think that kind of ties really nicely to your idea about the role of doubt.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I do after a very intense, you know, class with my students or a corporate workshop is I ask the question of, what are you still confused about? What are you still unsure about? Write about it for 1 minute. And what we know from the science is when you focus on what you still doubt, what you're unsure of and confused about, that increases your retention of the material because now you're connecting it to what your future self wants to potentially do and learn in the aftermath. Like, you want to read the footnotes. You want to go pick up a book. You want to double check, you know, when I say something like, you know, this leads to, you know, being able to actually very clearly define your emotions before you go out drinking leads to a 50% reduction in binge drinking episodes. Well, you might not trust me. It sounds too clear if I say 50%. So you're confused. I'm like, there's no way it's an even number like that. So it's really interesting, going back to education, and this also flows in the workplace. We focus so much on, okay, what have we acquired? What have we learned? What have we decided? As opposed to, like, what do we still not freaking know? And almost every meeting, if you want people to grow and continue developing ideas in the aftermath of this conversation or this session, you want to end on the doubt and confusion. Now, it doesn't feel good, but it's basically like, what does it do? It makes us learn and grow. And everyone says that they want that, but they don't like how it feels to end on a slightly unhappy note. And if there's one big takeaway that I want listeners to get from this practically is think about ending on a slightly unhappy note because of its function. And that's where the doubt and confusion becomes valuable.
Well, let's talk about risk in particular, because this really struck me. You said, as people become better able to satisfy their desire for comfort, they narrow the range of experiences and fall out of practice in navigating life's hardships. To put this in a linear way, one, material comforts and convenience items leads to an urge to use external goods to be at ease, which leads to lower psychological immunity circumstances that are less comfortable and more inconvenient. And, you know, you and I were talking about my nephew who just turned one this week. And, you know, I think that I am writing this life advice book for him. And I decided for the essay I was going to write the other day, I was like, you know, every year I write down lessons from my birthday for each year. But since you're only a year old, I'm going to share the 12 things I've learned from you. And what I realized is that he still has that, like, because he's young, he has a sort of dose of recklessness that we tend to lose with age. And as you lose that, I realized that your range of what's possible in life becomes more and more limited as you lower your tolerance for risk, and risk is uncomfortable.
Yeah. I love everything you're describing. I love the idea that you are clarifying lessons learned by the time, you know, by the time he reads that, he won't even know who this person was that you were speaking of.
Yeah.
There's so much that we gain from the perspective of, like, you know, a child's perspective on the world. Catherine Warner, I think that's her name. She coined this term emotional safeguarding. And what she means is that middle-class parents in particular, so now picking on the upper classes and upper classes, is they want their kids to be intellectually challenged. Like I want you to do what I did. I want you to read 1984 and Lord of the Flies. Like, how come you're reading Harry Potter, and how come you're reading, you know, graphic comic books, like, in grade school? Like, you're not learning the classics. And yet, we prevent them from being challenged emotionally and socially. And so if we see them being picked on in the playgrounds, I mean, we're jumping right in, grabbing that kid, grabbing a teacher and saying, hey, listen, kid cannot say anything negative to my kid. And so we're not allowing their conflict resolution skills to develop because we're taking away their autonomy. We're jumping in too quickly. Now, I'm against bullying, against harassment, against violence. But you have to realize, like, you have to ask these provocative questions of, how do you develop an ability to deal with people who have differing views than yourself, differing perspectives than yourself? How do you deal with people that, like, disagree with you, like, in public? How do you deal with people that embarrass you in public? How do you deal with people that make you anxious because of whatever reason? You think they have more status. You think they're cooler than you. You think they're, you know, they have more money than you. We can't just give a bullet point on a PowerPoint slide to our kids of how to deal with this. They have to learn it. And then we deconstruct in the aftermath. What happened? What do you wish happened? What were you expecting to happen? And then, like, who are your icons? Who are the heroic people that you see in your environment that are really good at this thing that you had trouble with today? And who's really bad at it?
Mm.
And you're doing this is, like, you're not telling them. You're having them show themselves, like, what it's like to be emotionally and socially challenged. And again, this is one of these cultural and sociological mechanisms that makes us psychologically weak in a world where we need to have this ability to tolerate, like, so much pain and so much difficulty that's going to occur in our lifetime.
So it makes me think about what we teach or don't teach, for that matter, in school when it comes to, so I wrote this article titled What We Should Have Learned in School But Never Did. To date, the most read thing I've ever written. It went viral on Medium. And one of the things I realized, just based on all the conversations I've had in the past 10 years with people like you, is we really don't teach anything about one of the most sort of critical skills for navigating adult life, which is managing our psychology. There is nothing about that in school. Like, most of us basically, you know, have to go through hell and find ourselves in therapy to realize that, oh, this is actually really important. So from the vantage point of an educator, what do you think that we need to incorporate into the way that we're educating people, particularly when we're talking, you know, like K through 12, about this aspect of life? Because it seems like such a critical skill, yet we're so focused on sort of the basics of, like, math, science, reading, whatever, but we don't teach you anything about this.
Yeah. Can I tell you, like, one of my favorite moments of one of my twin daughters?
Yeah, absolutely.
So when she was in elementary school, the band teacher, her incentives financially, she would get, like, a bonus based on how many people joined band. And there was, like, a slow systematic decline in the number of kids like band because she was kind of annoying. And she was not allowed to cajole or persuade the kids directly to go into band. So after class, between classes, she grabbed a whole bunch of these kids. I think she was in fifth grade. So they're young. And she said, like, listen, like, you guys did band. You were the ones that did band last year. Some of you decided not to do it this year. And I want to encourage you, like, you should be doing it. Like, music is good for you. And she really pressured them. And my daughter raised her hand and said, I'm pretty sure, like, we were told, like, you're not allowed to push us into choosing band or not. And she grabbed her arm, yelled at her, and then brought her to the principal's office of stuff, like an act of, like, disagreeing with an authority figure in front of other kids. I get the phone call. I come into the school and this is basically what I told the vice principal was, imagine
like when my daughter, Chloe, like goes into middle school and high school, and imagine like there's a boy that's like snapping her bra from behind her, like in the seat behind her. And then she gets mad and she says, don't do that. And she does it twice and he does it a third time. Like, when would you like think it's appropriate for my daughter to assert herself and develop a sense of agency and empowerment to like speak up for things? Because the starting point is right here, like right here in fifth grade. She might not have used the proper like words and respect when she did it, but she's, it's scaffolding. Like, you can shape an assertive woman right now. And what you've done and this teacher have done is say, it is bad that you spoke up against some injustice that you saw. You're training her to accept the guy in high school who's going to snap her bra from the seat behind her. And I'm saying, I will always defend her and say, this is the wrong way to go. And then we just had a conversation of like, you know, this, that she was totally in the right, but she phrased it wrong. Of course she phrased it wrong. Like, I phrase things wrong. Like, now when I get upset at adults, just happened 2 nights ago at a concert of explosions in the sky. You know, it's, and what we need to be doing is looking for when kids are irritated and they're anxious and they're sad and they're missing their parents, whatever, or they feel as if like, you know, they feel as if they're stupid because they're not getting a concept everyone else is getting in the class. Teachers should look for those moments. They are like the best growth building moments that exist. And instead, we often penalize, punish, or just try to soothe them. It's the wrong way to go. It's like basically they have a early warning system message their brain is saying is that there is a goal that's not being met that's important to them. And our job as adult figures is to help them work through that, not to punish and soothe them.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I love that. I wish that that was more prevalent in the way that we are taught in school, because I think that you are taught not to challenge authority at any cost. I mean, particularly you grew up in an Indian culture, you're taught very early on that you just don't challenge authority. And, you know, that works for a long time. And then when you start to, it starts to create all sorts of conflict. But I think that that is such a critical skill. Let's talk about another idea here. You say that your happiness can interfere with long-term success. The pursuit of happiness sometimes backfires, ending in unhappiness. Sometimes people want to feel bad. Someone else's happiness can impair your performance. And, you know, the idea of not pursuing happiness as a goal, I think, is such a, it basically flies in the face of all this crap that we have heard from, you know, self-help books. And I think that what I'm really curious about is understanding this distinction between happiness, fulfillment, and pleasure, because I think that, you know, we can make those things mutually exclusive. We can have both at the same time, or we can basically push some of those. For example, you can push pleasure to the point of diminishing returns in numerous ways. I mean, let's face it, some recreational drugs are pleasurable to use, you know?
Right. One good way of thinking about it is there's some research by Islet Fishback. I think that's how you pronounce her name.
Yep.
Fishback.
She was the first guest this year.
Oh, sweet. Oh, yeah. She's great. Yeah. She's in my author club. So she has this great work of think about it as a 2x2 matrix, which is convert all complex ideas into 2x2 matrices. So one is, what emotion are you feeling? Like, are you feeling happy or unhappy? And then what is the goal in this moment? Is it to manage your mood to feel better, or to improve or enhance the self in some way, however that's defined? But this gets to the question of like, what's success? What's greatness? Like, well, you know, what is genius? And what she finds is that people that actually feel good and then are trying to improve their mood to stay in that good state, they put less effort into tasks. They're less creative. And it makes sense, because if you're feeling satisfied, if I was feeling satisfied that we've already covered like everything I'd like to cover in a conversation, then I just sit back and just let you talk, and we don't have to have like a two-way conversation. If I feel satisfied that I've accomplished everything I want in the workplace, well, there's no motivation for me to think about an innovative product or where our customers might be more gains that are possible with whatever product that we're delivering. And when you focus on trying to enhance the self, and then it doesn't matter whether you feel good or bad, is like, you're going to be stimulated to continue to commit and work toward a goal, as opposed to aborting prematurely.
And what I think we want, you know, you had this like whole thing by Roy Baumeister on willpower of like, we have a limited amount of willpower. That's why, you know, we can't work out for 3 hours a day. And we're, you know, we're not going to a marathon. Just because you run a marathon doesn't mean you can run a 50-mile or 100-mile ultramarathon. Like, we have to build our willpower up to do these things. But one of the ways of getting out of the limited amount of willpower that we have is to alter the goal that we have going into a situation. And we have to like resist temptation to go into mood enhancement mode. And if you think about dating, if you think about work meetings, if you think about spending time with your kids, the goal shouldn't constantly be for everyone to feel good and for everyone to be friends, because very often it's exactly the opposite that leads to whatever the desired outcome is. We have to clarify what is the thing that we're hoping to attain. And in group situations, it's often the best decision making, which often means you're going to have a couple, if not a whole bunch of unhappy people, because not everyone's going to get what they want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, with that in mind, this is one of those things that I have asked so many people. How do you find a balance between fulfillment and ambition, knowing that, you know, there's value to being dissatisfied? Because let's take publishing, for example. You and I were talking about, you know, Ryan Holiday, and he had this really great example where we were talking about one of his books. And he said, you know, he's gotten to do with these things that, you know, most people would kill for, you know, write the books he's wanted to write and have a career that most people would give anything for. And he said, you'd think I would wake up every day and like think, oh, life is awesome. He said, but nobody does that. He said, you know, it's basically the metaphor he used is like people basically, they, you know, they think to themselves, all right, I hit a home run. He's like, no, that's not it. It's, you know, a grand slam. He's like, no, that's not it. It's a grand slam in the World Series or the highest contract in baseball. And he said, the truth is, if nobody, you know, if everybody was happy being a senator, nobody would run for president. And I think what struck me most was when he said, and that belief drives a lot of achievement. And in the aggregate, it's true, but on the individual level, it's a lie. Yeah. And that always stayed with me as something so profound. And yet it, the other side of me thought, yeah, but you're Ryan Holiday. Of course you can say that. It's easy to say when you're in your position.
Yeah. I mean, I love what Ryan's saying. I mean, just think about it in parenting. Like when are you fulfilled? Like when have you reached the destination? Like it doesn't happen. Like it's just stages and phases that you go into. I mean, You know, there was a time where my kids would listen to me wholeheartedly if I had like an interesting idea or thought. And now I get, you know, the bombastic side up, like when I say something in front of their friends of like some kind of interesting research I read. It's a new phase where their peers are more important than their adult figure. And so now I have to, you go from satisfaction to slight dissatisfaction of like, all right, this is a cue that I'm no longer matching the context perfectly. And so there's basically like a period of having to like of adaptation that's required for the situation to get off of the hedonic treadmill where we're constantly chasing like this, you know, these golden outcomes is really to acknowledge, take a moment of appreciating like past, you know, your past version of yourself, your present version of yourself and the future version of yourself. And I think as you're saying, one of the things with highly ambitious, successful people where they have a problem is they keep changing who their social comparator is. And thus they never end up getting headway into feeling fulfilled. And one of the ways of getting off of that constant uptick in new, more profound, more impactful people that you're comparing yourself to is to take sufficient time on a daily basis or a weekly basis, build it into your schedule where you're going to reflect on like how far you've come. And when we play with this timeline of, you know, 15-year-old Ryan Holiday and 18-year-old Ryan Holiday, and however old he is now, then you start to realize like, holy cow, like I would have never expected that people were basically going to invoke my name on a podcast where I'm not even on it in the first place. This is like a crazy concept. And my bet is even someone who's is such a stoic such as himself is he doesn't spend sufficient time doing that. And we all need to get better at having that nostalgia for what we expected to be and look how far we've come.
Without a doubt. Well, I mean, I think that one thing I've realized is that there is no point in which you bridge this gap between who you are and who you want to be. Like that gap is eternal because that's just how we are hardwired as humans. And I remember with Sasha Hines here and we're talking about, you know, one of the things that is related to hedonic adaptation. And she said, basically what ends up happening as you become more successful is your reference group changes. So when your reference group changes, so does what you consider success. And, you know, like you and I are both published authors. And I remember, like I said, basically what happens is, you know, I go from Srini, the sort of author lingering in obscurity, to being now at Penguin Portfolio, where my peers are Ryan Holiday, Simon Sinek, and Seth Godin. So no longer am I the guy who went from obscurity to, you know, published author with Portfolio. I'm the redheaded stepchild of Penguin Portfolio.
Right.
Because the reference group changes. You know? And she said that if you look at the Olympic podium, the person who wins the silver is the least happy every single time.
Yeah.
Because in their mind, they see themselves as the person who didn't win the gold, whereas the person who wins the bronze apparently is just happy that they're on the podium.
Exactly. I love how you've integrated all the psychological research. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Well, yeah. Like I said, my brain is like an encyclopedia of the things that I've learned from people like you.
Yeah. I mean, I also think that we have to consider that we have very narrow definitions of what success and greatness looks like that is imposed on us by our social milieu. And so, you know, if you go to Sri Lanka or Cambodia or, you know, Vietnam, they're not having conversations about comparing themselves to Seth Godin, like the average person. I mean, the average successful person is they're focusing on like, listen, like I'm a member of my community. I've got this awesome like restaurant here. It's relatively packed. People are telling me that they love it. I'm getting tons of excellent reviews and they're good. And this goes back to the amount of social comparisons that are available to us and social media where we have too much access to what is possible. And we have, and because of that, we are not making an internally generated idea of what's possible. Like we really have to, I mean, this is the value of like meditation retreats or just walking in nature is like, we want a reset of like, okay, irrespective of what all other people are doing and what my parents want and what my mentors want and friends would like for me, like how would my like my life to be? And just go through each life domain, spirituality, friendship, work, leisure, physical health, mental health. And once you start doing these reflections that are independent of what society is telling us, you'll often find, as you just said, like these wild mismatches where it is amazing how little time that I spend per week with white space, like of not having something stimulate me. You know, one of the big mm-hmm. changes that I made in my life in the past year post the pandemic was not listening to audiobooks because I was just collecting, downloading too much information and I wasn't spending enough time reflecting, which is always what made me like a creative thinker, like a good researcher. And it's while I miss reading 75 or listening to 75 books per year, the benefit mental health wise to me and being more creative is an amazing trade-off. And it's always a trade-off.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, one thing that I think really struck me that you said was that to motivate, improve performance and survive, you have to give yourself permission to engage in acts of dominance, aggression, strategic manipulation, and selfishness. Putting yourself, family, and innermost circle first. This is as true for leaders with a capital L as in heads of companies or with a small L as in anyone who is trying to influence someone else. By embracing the Teddy effect, you access a 20% edge that you and the majority of society prematurely dismiss. And I think that if I hadn't finished reading that section, the people would have heard that first sentence and thought to themselves like, wow, this sounds really obnoxious, like dominance, aggression, strategic manipulation, and selfishness. And, you know, I think that we all have those qualities to varying degrees. You know, like I'll give you an example. I had a very difficult choice to make between somebody we worked with and a project that was going to be something that basically did wonders for our brand. And I realized I was like, I'm going to basically kill a friendship permanently in order to move the business forward. And I don't feel like I have a choice here. Like this is going to be something that pays off and we have to make this choice.
Yeah. I'm glad you're tackling the Teddy Roosevelt effect because I think this is really important. The most negative feedback that we've gotten from this book is this chapter because they don't realize we're talking about low grade narcissism, low grade specific dimensions of psychopathy. Because we think of Jeffrey Dahmer, Ted Bundy, you know, now that serial has like, you know, serial killers have become like our entertainment. I mean, we think of like the Dexters, like the worst characters possible. And just like you said, we're all really big on persuasion and manipulation, but some of it looks really wonderful. So strategically giving people's gifts, handing out compliments, giving people like thank you emails. There is a strategic action that's taking place here. This falls under this category of like positively balanced Machiavellian strategies. Like, we are selfish characters. We feel good. It makes other people feel good. And so we kind of get like a green check where society says that's good. And what all we wanted to say was, is that you have psychological tools that you are prematurely discarding because they don't feel good. And sometimes dominance is required. I mean, when you, you know, one of the things that I've always defined myself as, because of, I'm a pretty big guy, I work out a lot, and I'm pretty assertive because I grew up in New York City, is I had always had the temperament where I could bully bullies. Like, when I see someone bullying someone, there's always these scenarios where I'm like, damn, is anyone else going to stop being a bystander? And like, why do I always have to step in? My kids have already gotten into the practice. Like, damn, why do you always have to be the one who like stops crimes thinking you're like a freaking superhero? Like, we were on a New York City subway. It was coming back from, an off-Broadway theater. And there was this big guy with, remember, big thick glasses, and this woman fell asleep and he was rifling through her backpack. And I'm looking around thinking of like, everyone knows this is happening. And I'm like, damn it, why do I have to be the one that actually says something? And then I said something, and the guy, like, basically, you know, like a typical bro chancho, is like, you know, like, you want something? You want to fight? I'm like, listen, I'm not like in third grade anymore. I don't fight adults. I'm saying just like, leave the woman who's asleep alone. Like, that's, and then I'm like waiting for someone else to jump in, and someone doesn't. So this act of dominance, recklessness, call it impulsivity, it has its benefits. Like, you know, this isn't a story for me to like look good. It's basically, is like, we have this ability to speak up and amplify the voice of people who can't speak for themselves. And in this case, there's a woman asleep on a subway who's being robbed. I could turn the other cheek, but going back to the psychology of regret, I know I'm going to kick myself forever if like he goes further and does something even worse. And so I make the choice of like to step in and do something. And that's like a little bit of the Teddy effect of like, of realizing that you do have this grandiosity a little bit. And it's a good thing that you feel that you're the one that could save a situation. You could improve a situation. And how horrible would it be if listeners here were a zero on 100-point narcissism scale? Like, that you didn't think your strengths were amazing. You didn't think like you had skills that were awesome and other people could actually learn something from. Now, as a clinical psychologist, I would never want any of my clients to be zero on narcissism scale. You kind of want them to be like a 12.
Yeah. Well, you have this line in the book where you say narcissists have grandiose visions of themselves, which result in the vigorous pursuit of goals where they get to showcase just how unique, visionary, and potent they think they are. And it got me like, right, as reading that out loud, I'm thinking to myself, every single person who has a personal brand then would qualify as a narcissist, myself included.
Yeah. I mean, who was the posters and the heroes like when you were a kid growing up?
For me, I think it was Superman.
Was there any like scientist or athlete or like actor, actress?
Michael Jordan, because I grew up in the Jordan era when he was on the Bulls. And yeah, if you read anything about Michael Jordan in any biography, it's safe to say he definitely was a narcissist who had grand visions of himself. And rumor has it, in Roland Lazenby's book, I don't remember the exact title, but he said that Michael Jordan showed up on day one of practice for the Chicago Bulls, and he played like it was game 7 of the NBA finals, and he expected everybody else to play the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. And then his successor, Kobe Bryant, was really high narcissism. I mean, my understanding of before games when they were at, you know, the Lakers court, is that he would come in the earliest, despite making the most money and having the most prestige, and he would take up half the court would be him, and the other half the court would be the rest of the team. But he got there first. Like, he wanted them to know, just like you're describing with Jordan, is like, listen, I'm freaking awesome, but I am going to outwork all of you, and I'm going to earn the reason why I get so much attention and so much money that happens there. So that's the element of narcissism that's healthy. That's narcissistic admiration. Like, you think you have these amazing strengths and you feel like the world should be exposed to them. Now, you have the unhealthy side of narcissism, which is called narcissistic rivalry. And that's basically when you are, you believe you have these strengths and you are going to step on the foot and step on the head of anyone that tries to get into your space. And you're not going to let anyone practice and you're not going to let anyone be a talent that's going to be next to you. And there's plenty of athletes that fall into that category where it's the unhealthy element. World Meta, who's also in the Lakers, he would mm-hmm. he had more of like this narcissistic rivalry. He would get into fights with other players on the court, thought that they were trying to show him up, as opposed to these are all, you know, the upper echelon, like the top 1% of basketball players on earth. Like everybody should be trying to show up everyone. And so the two, you want to be, to feel as if you have sufficient strengths that other people could potentially admire you if you brought it to full fruition. But you don't want to be stepping on other people trying to get to that point. And that's separating the healthy and the unhealthy parts.
Well, speaking of unhealthy and healthy, let's talk about pleasure and fulfillment, because you talked about pleasure and meaning in two different ways. You say that we're, it turns out, short-term hedonists and long-term saints. What's more, nobody can be accurately categorized as an exclusively pleasure person or meaning person. A life of meaning that's devoid of pleasure is frankly no fun. On the other hand, a life fully given over to the pursuit of pleasure may miss out on the benefits of having objectives that we aspire to accomplish or to become, namely, a purpose in life. So say more about that. Like, you know, how do you find this sort of balance between pleasure and meaning?
Yeah. I mean, everything we're talking about is like we're moving away from a focus on a single attribute to having this huge matrix or profile of dimensions, right? So, I mean, you've probably had them on your show. You know, you've got Angela Duckworth is grit and Michael McCulloch is forgiveness and Bob Emmons is gratitude. And, you know, Martin Seligman, it talks about perspection. And I wrote a book on curiosity. And all these singular dimensions are not the panacea to make life fulfilling, interesting, valuable, or joyful. And we have to think of ourselves and other people in a more complex way. Like we have this profile. And, you know, yesterday you and I were talking about surfing. You were talking about being in Nicaragua and I've done it in El Salvador. Is that surfing is an interesting blend of meaning and happiness and richness. It's got all three of those in there, but they're different moments. So the mm-hmm. idea of, you know, there's those when you're just sitting on your board after you caught a wave and you're just prideful and you feel alive and you're like, oh my God, I feel like today's like one of those days where I'm really in my body and I feel like really coordinated that goes in there. Relish that, savor that awesomeness, like savor that, like, you know, that self-aggrandizing experience that you just had. And you don't have to share it with anybody. Like, but like, don't just go right to the next wave. You know, you're sitting there and like, look at the sunset and like, enjoy that stuff. And at the same time, if you are a surfer and you want to be better at surfing, like spend all of that cognitive energy trying to, you know, time the wave and like, you know, have the foot placement properly and like, you know, have the, make sure that your core, like you're fully activated so you can get up as opposed to just, you know, ride it like a boogie board. That there's in the singular activity at the same episode, you have moments of meaning, moments of growth, and moments of great joy. And to live a really good life is to really dive in and like explore and savor each one of those elements of well-being when they arise. And I think too much we get overly obsessed with one of these elements of well-being and we forget that the other ones are absolutely essential. And my icon for thinking about this has always been Martin Luther King. Like you rarely find a picture of Martin Luther King Jr. where he's like really smiling and like laughing hysterically. There's a few of them, but most of the time he's somber, he's serious, and he's fighting like, you know, one of the greatest injustices of, you know, of human history in one time. And he sacrificed the joy, the pleasure, like, you know, that just kind of that exuberance for a life of meaning. And we're all better off for it. But I would say is like, most of us don't have to make that kind of extreme sacrifice. And most of us will not make that much of a meaningful accomplishment. And it's not that I'm saying we can't, there aren't future Martin Luther King Jr.'s that are listening here. But I'm saying is that you can live a life with more balance and you might even be better at those ultimate concerns that you're focused on.
Well, I think that makes a beautiful place to finish our conversation. I mean, you and I could talk all day about this because it's so rich. And like I said, we'll have you back to talk about your other book. But I want to finish with my final question, which is how we finish all of our interviews. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
For me, I think it is to follow along with this matrix of attributes, to really tap into your unique matrix in terms of the books you've read, the people you've met, the skills you have with your personality traits, and the positive and negative life events that you've experienced. You have a perspective that is unlike anyone else on earth. So do not try to mimic anyone that you find as like iconic or impressive to you, because it's your unique perspective and your unique stories that are going to make you unmistakable and basically invaluable.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story, your wisdom, and your insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, your books, and everything else?
I mean, you can find everything on toddpagin.com, and all my books are on Amazon and a couple of airports in some strange third world country. That's about it.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Witness history at Roland Garros, where old rivalries meet new talent on the clay battleground. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled access as the world's top players in tennis face off to see if the veterans maintain their dominance or if a fresh face rises to challenge them. Daily live coverage of the French Open begins Monday, May 20th. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The Four Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The Four Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.